I mean, we could start many different places because we've actually known each other all of our lives, right?
From private school, which people would probably find for me and you kind of hilarious that don't know our story.
Right. Like, we started out in ties and hard shoes.
Ties, hard shoes, big, thick, heavy book bags. I don't know. Big, you know, getting beat when we didn't get our test right, when we didn't get 100.
That's
right.
People
don't know that.
I touched on that in the first episode because I had your brother sitting with me, right? So, you know, hailing from Brooklyn, East Flatbush, you know, when we came up, we were surrounded by, how could I put it? Crime wasn't bad, but a lot of the criminals that came out of our neighborhoods actually came from two-parent households. They came from good homes.
Right.
They just chose to do the wrong thing.
Which is interesting because growing up, like we grew up on the cusp, I guess, you know, of the really, really bad part, which was kind of, you know, at that time, you know, the Brownsville section, we basically grew up in the 90s and the 50s, basically.
That's right.
Right? Which was kind of an extension of, you know, that entire area. So, yeah, you're right. Like we basically had two-parent households. You know, people, you know, most of our parents owned homes, which was, you know, a blessing for us because everybody didn't have that, you know, opportunity. And we got to, you know, grow up where, you know, we had those decisions. You know, some of that bad element kind of like, you know, was an influence on us coming up. And you're right, it was pretty interesting for us to be in that element, but getting off of a yellow school bus with a tie and hard shoes coming from private school every day.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting. It was different. Whereas most of my friends on the block, they basically went to either Wingate, 391, Winthrop, Junior High. So, you know, for us, we were, you know, I was mad about it at the time because I'm like, yo, why can't I just wear my regular clothes and go to school?
That's right.
Like, why I got to throw on the uniform, the tie, and look all crazy coming when everybody else is getting out of school, they got their regular clothes on. And then it's time to, you know, play and run around. We got the white shirt, blue tie, and the hard bottoms.
That's right. Well, no. See, we were probably two of maybe six or seven in the school that were fortunate to have British walkers, Playboys.
That's true.
We made it look good.
We were schoolboy fly.
Right, we were schoolboy fly.
We were schoolboy fly, for sure. Definitely had those British walkers, see? Playboys.
So you know, and that's where we first met. And it was so early on in life that it kind of seemed like we were related because the people that we ended up meeting later on in life didn't know us that long.
Right.
Right. So for us to tell people at that time, yo, I've known this dude since, it didn't make sense. So for me to go, you know, this is my cousin, you had to kind of believe that. But now in life,
right.
And I think about this often, right? So even on the drive up here, meditating on how we're going to actually roll out our conversation, because it could never be a Q&A. I can't ask you questions that I know the answers to, and not even for the sake of the viewer, right? That only has heard of you and they don't know you.
Right.
See, I can't do that either, right? Because I'll be doing them a disservice, because the story is so intricate that you being the person that has lived your story, mm-hmm. you're doing it, you're alive, you're living. Okay. You're not looking at yourself. You're not listening to yourself.
Correct.
Right? So I've been doing that for as long as we've known each other.
Right.
Right? And his parents, who are no longer here, were like my parents. I didn't know that they felt the way they felt about me, you know,
right.
until.
Right.
Okay? Cool. you have always been up to something, right? So even you doing the businesses you're doing now, it's true. Right. You doing the businesses you're doing now, I'm going to blow your mind. Trust me. Because you're not thinking about what I'm thinking about in relation to yourself.
Right.
Right? Your kids, you don't know what they're thinking about.
Right.
Right? So if you were to ask anybody you're around, what do you think about when you think about me? Wow. It would blow your mind because everyone's going to say something different. Why? Right. Because there are angles and right. everybody's looking at you from different angles. Everybody has a different role in your life.
Right.
Cool. So in business, you're still the same person.
Absolutely. I think from early on, I was always enterprising. And, you know, you touched on my parents a little bit. They were always the type of parents that, you know, wanted a better life for their family, for their children, for themselves. So I grew up in Bed-Stuy. I'm born in Bed-Stuy. Let me say that, on Hancock and Throop. So in a brownstone, right? I actually have found some video of them pushing me in a carriage down the street on that block. And what happened was they rented a room when they came to this country. They basically rented a room in one of these brownstones, right? I guess room rentals or, you know, sharing rooms was pretty popular back then. But they always wanted to own their own home. So here it comes around 1970. They got a chance to own their own home, moved to East Flatbush, the 90s. And we end up, you know, growing up in a home instead of, you know, them really. I mean, they worked hard to get that. It wasn't easy. They, you know, they both had to work two jobs. My dad, you know, worked at the airlines, you know, aircraft mechanic, and then drove a cab at nights, you know, to, you know, get everything together to get up, save enough money to make that move. So seeing all those things, not knowing it as a little kid, but seeing how hard they worked, I always knew I wanted to work and always, like you said, be up to something. So even as a kid, like 11 years old, I would go to Key Food on Utica and Rutland, and I'd pack bags for Key Food's a gross supermarket store. I used to pack bags for the people that were getting groceries, primarily a lot of the older people that they used to bring, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if they have them today, but the shopping carts.
The carts, absolutely.
Their own shopping cart, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of them lived in these walk-ups in back of Key Food, and they would ask me, like, can you, you know, help me with my bags? Of course. So it'll be maybe one or two, three kids at the end of the counter packing the bags, and then they would give us some of the loose change when they got the change. So a lot of times I would come home, and this was after school. After I came to school, I was 11 years old. Right? This was my first job. So I was always trying to figure out a way how to basically make money. So I would come home with a pocket full of change, then I'd take that change and I'll add it to, you know, my allowance I would get from my pops. My pops, for cleaning the house and washing his car, he'd give me $5. So I put the $5 in my change and, you know, just keep saving and saving and saving. I always have like a whole lot of change, dimes, nickels, quarters. And that's how I knew the value, like, you know, quarters added, and I'll change it into dollars. So quarters added to dollars, dollars added to fives, tens, whatever. So I always had that mentality, not necessarily of flipping it, but just, you know, gathering, you know, like just gathering money and putting money together. So even as a kid, like when everybody else was playing, from as soon as I got that, you know, we had to be in the house at a certain time. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I had that shot, as soon as I got home and I was able to cross, you know, go across the street by myself and go to the supermarket, I said, you know what? I'm gonna pack these groceries for these people, and if they want to pay me to do so, if they feel that it's cool to pay me to do it, because they can pack their own groceries, but they figure, you know what? This guy could go and snatch someone's pocketbook, but instead he's here packing groceries, trying to get, you know, make some extra money. So that's what I did, and then I make even more money when I used to take them, walk them with their cart, and bring the groceries a couple of flights up for the older ladies.
Man.
Yeah, so that was my, like, that was my first
hustle.
And then after that, it just turned into all sorts of things, from baseball cards to fireworks to...
Yeah, you know, and that's a, you know, that's another thing that really bothered me all these years, and I never brought it up to you, right?
Oh, boy, here we go.
You robbed me.
I ain't robbed
you. You robbed me for some baseball cards, right? And I was always a small kid, right? Until I was 18. I was small. Yo, you bullied some baseball cards from me, champ.
I don't think so.
Yeah, and we was arguing about a point, and we was flipping up to 200 cards at a time.
Oh, man.
We
collect baseball cards, and then we'll flip them. We'd play the thing with the colors. I think it was matching the colors at that time. We'd do that. We'd flip. We was always doing something.
But now, hold that point. So that was private school.
Right.
Cool. Then when we, we kind of went estranged for a short period of time.
Right.
Probably high school for me.
Right.
And then we ended up bumping into each other in college.
Yep.
Borough, Manhattan.
Yep. I think you, right. We ended up going to
that was 1988.
Right. And again, right. We bumped into each other in 88 in BMCC.
Right. And then from there, we were in D.C.
Right. Then we went to D.C.
Okay.
Going to school out there and, you know, doing what, you know, these guys were doing, you know, going from New York to D.C., trying to figure it out, just doing stupidness. But, you know, thank God it all worked out. But, yeah, we end up seeing each other D.C. again.
Now, I've always been an aspiring rapper. So I always talked music, breakdancing. That was always my thing.
Right.
Right? So let me ask you if you remember, probably in, I want to say 1990, maybe. Maybe 90. I came to D.C. and I drove down there just to have one conversation with you. You remember that?
I think so. I think okay. I remember that.
I had met a producer that kind of groomed me into the industry, Howie T.
Yep.
You might know him from Chub Rock, Special Ed, Full Force, Real Roxanne, right? He had a meeting with Andre Harrell, who was the head of Uptown Records back then. And Andre had just hired Puffy, who y'all know as Diddy, right? And after he was interning, he gave him a shot at an A&R position.
I remember.
His first task was to put together an album for Father MC.
Right.
So he got a list of all the producers that, you know, were hot at the time or whatever, and songwriters, and Puffy wanted to have a meeting with every last one of them. But Andre would sit in on these meetings.
Right.
Like, kind of like hold his hand.
Right.
So I watched him groom himself too, right? And you also, because he was going to Howard with Mark Pitts.
Right.
So we saw that before that was a that.
Right.
Before that was a thing.
Right.
Right? Now, show you how this all ties in. So they have the meeting with Howie. And they're like, yo, what have you been working on? And that meant, you know, what artists are you cultivating in your studio now? Like, unknown. So he pulls out one of my demos, right? And he plays it. And they're like, yo, who is that? It's like, yo, this is my man Sean. I didn't even have a rap name, right? So they were like, yo, could we meet him? So he was like, yeah. I had already been signed to Select Records in 87. Right. So that's I'm probably like...
I remember that.
Yeah, I'm probably like... And I got beat for $4,000, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm probably like the first rapper to ever go up to a label with a gun, right? I was like, this is not it. Right? I can't be outside all day with nothing to show for it. My pops is like, why you outside all day and you not making no money, you not working?
Right.
So after that didn't work, I went back to the block,
right?
Right? So Howie comes and pulls up on the block in his BMW, and I'm like, what are you doing over here? This ain't the place for you. Mm-hmm. He's like, yo, listen, get in the car. I got to holler at you. I said, man, I'm dirty. I'm not getting in your car. He said, yo, dude, get in the car.
Right.
get in the car. He's telling me about the meeting. He said, yo, they want to meet you tomorrow. I'm like, about what? I was turned off to the music industry.
Right.
Said, ain't no bread in it. You can't rob me without a gun.
Right.
The next day, I go up there. Andre and Puffy, they're sitting there smiling. And I walk in. I didn't know what to expect. And they said, have a seat, sat down, met them, shook their hands. And the first thing they asked me, Andre said, yo, what do you think about LL Cool J? And I was like, why does this dude ask me about LL? Who was my favorite artist at the time.
Right.
But being from Brooklyn, you know, I'm like, he all right. And they bust out laughing. They thought it was funny.
Right.
That meeting turned into me writing half of Father MC's album.
Wow. I remember that.
That also turned into me and Puffy hanging out every day. Okay? They found Jodeci, had him in a house in Jersey. They was looking crazy with blonde hair and big shoes. Mm-hmm. I watched him do every job imaginable. But in watching that, and I know you're like, how is this going to tie into our conversation?
Oh, no, I already
you remember now, right?
Yeah.
Good. So now I learned how to run a label.
Right.
Bad Boy wasn't even a thought.
Right, because he was working that.
It was just Uptown.
Yeah.
I drove to D.C. Now I'm getting money now.
Right.
I left the block alone. I'm like, it's money in this.
Right.
I'm hanging around this dude, right?
Right.
So sorry I didn't stay around that guy. But I drove to D.C. I said, Pooh, I got it.
Right.
We're going to start an independent label.
Right.
I got money. You got money. Homie got bread.
Right.
We're going to put it in. And you said to me, there's no money in music. I'm good.
Clear.
Said, what?
Clearly.
I wanted to kill you. Yo, and you, man, you wouldn't budge because you were doing what you were doing. And the type of person you are, when something's working for you, you're going to beat it.
I'm going all
to the wheels. Would that be a proper assessment?
No, absolutely proper assessment of my character when it comes to business. So I want to say earlier on, and I think you touched on it a little bit. So I was so the seeds were already planted in my head about the music because I watched when, you know, when you got the Capitol deal back in the day. Right?
Yes, that was right.
So I watched when that happened, and then, you know.
When I bust that check.
Right, so yeah, and it was like six digits. So
and,
I'm like.
And I pulled up.
So oh yeah, you pulled up in the red Acura coupe. Like, you know, it was real. So I'm like, wait a minute. This guy's driving like how I'm driving. And, you know, he's putting out music. So that's when I kind of started figuring, then again, seeing Puff going from an intern to developing these artists, like you said, and then watching his growth, like, so fast. And again, he's the exception to the rule because he's able to manage, and he's just such a talent finder, whether it's writers, artists, or whatever, and put all the pieces together and stay with the pieces and walk it all the way through mm-hmm. which I'm going to talk about one instance with him later mm-hmm. that I actually lived and walked through when he did have Bad Boy, but just to see his energy, because we were all in D.C., and to see him basically sneak on the train to go to, because he was doing parties down there. Him and Derek Angeletti was doing parties. And then he had this opportunity to intern at Uptown, and he saw the vision, and he would go, like you said, and then unbeknownst to me, what would happen is, like, maybe he's working, like when you talk about we were disconnected, I'm in D.C. already, you're in New York working on the music side, but again, he's coming up to New York before he decided to permanently move there, setting everything up for, you know, his position that he would eventually have. So yeah, he's putting things together, but he's putting things together with you and a lot of other people that I know also. So long story short, he ends up becoming, I guess, working from A&R to vice president of A&R and doing all these great things, like you said, doing deals with you, putting deals together to make all of these other, you know, artists successful. And then I started to say to myself, like, maybe there is something, maybe I'm missing something in this game. And then, going back to what I was saying before, what really inspired me, I don't know if you remember this, but I went to Howie T's garage, studio in his garage behind his house. And I was like, and I think I watched him make a beat. I forget what beat he was doing.
Well, you had to be there coming to see me.
Yeah, I was coming to see you. So yeah, so I came by the studio to come see you in the garage, and there was you know, some nice cars in the garage, mm-hmm. right in the driveway. I'm like, these guys, I think I had a BMW with BBS rims, mm-hmm. and I'm like,
I think it was a Gold 5 series.
Gold 5 series, yep. And this is around 91. And I came to holler at you, and you was working on something. I think you were writing for somebody. I don't know who it was. But how he was making the beat, you were writing. Then y'all finished that, and then y'all did something else. Then you was writing something for you. Then it was like some Color Me Bad talk. I'm like, this dude's kind of like figuring this out. And, you know, how he teased about to buy something new. And I think, I don't know what he was into. If he did the cars or something.
Cars, yeah.
Like he has some like exotic magazines. I'm like, guys are getting it.
Oh, they yeah, we was working. Getting money. We was getting
yeah,
money.
Yeah, they getting it. Like, you know, and everything else around it is kind of like, you know, some other stuff going on in these Flatbushes, normal, everyday life. But then there's this one house with all these nice cars mm-hmm. with a studio on the back. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay. There's something here.
But you see,
I gotta figure this out.
You see,
I just have to figure out my part of it.
But you gotta keep in mind, right?
Right.
That I always saw this in you, even in school. I always saw that thing. So. My viewers, they are all accustomed to me saying I don't like people, and I'm protective of my energy.
Right.
I'm not going to be in business with someone I don't like. If I like you, I love you. Right. That's my thing.
Right.
Why? I don't want a sucker eating around me.
Right.
At my table.
Right.
So for me to get in the music industry and know how lucrative it was for me, I had made money, but I saw the independent game.
Right.
And I said, I drove 4 hours to come have this conversation with you.
Yeah,
I was so mad at this guy. I was like, dude.
At first it didn't strike me.
And
then as I saw everyone developing and everyone creating, everyone making, you know, and I got, one thing I do get is business. So. Understood, you know, royalties and publishing and things that you create that, you know, can pay you. It's one of the 7 income streams, like royalties that can, a piece of work that you create that can pay you forever.
Right.
Whether it's television, whether it's film, or whether it's, you know, a composition. It's something that I knew I had to be involved in. So I always stuck around it, and then how I end up kind of navigating my way through was because of my relationships with, you know, Mark Pinson, Biggie, and Puff. When he decided to do Bad Boy, he kind of, you know, I kind of was in behind the scenes, just like, you know what, I don't want to need to make any money. I just want to rock with y'all. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? I just want to learn on my own. I just want to, you know, kind of see how this all works, to see which part of the business that my business acumen could complement.
Right.
Right? So, you know, I did that, and, you know, with those relationships, I was able to kind of, you know, find my way into kind of Biggie's camp, per se, right?
Okay.
So when I started rolling with them, this is before Biggie came out, and he was still doing demos, working out of Scarsdale, like Puff had the Trackmasters mm-hmm. there. Yeah, the house, he was doing all this creative stuff. Again,
I remember that house in Scarsdale.
Yeah, a bunch of producers there. And
you remember the infamous pool party?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, gambling.
Okay.
Lots of stuff.
I was mad at you that day, but it's cool.
We got
by it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. actually, one thing I do remember, God bless the dead, is being Wolf going head-to-head on a pool table. Puff had this pool table in Scarsdale, and at the end it turned into, you know, everybody shooting dice at the end of the pool party.
I remember that.
And we went head to head, and I ended up, you know, leaving with a pocket full, and he was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna see you again. Don't worry, I'll see you. We end up seeing each other again, I think at Sharky's, it was another place where everybody hung out at. We end up, you know, playing again, but That was interesting.
You know, let me stop you there, because a lot of people, you know, have all heard the stories about Biggie that were recycled.
Right.
Right? And it stems from people not knowing anything else.
Right.
And the people that knew more not saying anything.
Right.
Or not having a platform to speak from.
Mm-hmm.
So you hanging around Biggie's camp all the time.
Right.
Going to all the shows, traveling right. on your own dime.
Yep.
Right?
On the road.
After the shows, shooting $1,000 a roll.
Yeah, that's the story that people really don't know. So me and Biggie also like this game called CeeLo, three dice game, you know, famous in the hood, famous in Brooklyn, famous uptown as well. We used to always play. After Biggie got his show, he would grab a bag of money. Oh man, I miss this guy so much. And sometimes we would have a G a roll. We would go head up a G a roll. Sometimes he would win, sometimes I would win, but this guy was lucky. He would win more often than I would.
There's footage of him on the floor shooting dice, yeah. And that was a G a roll, and yeah. People didn't realize
that. They realized that. That shot actually got, I think, caught in, I think, the Source magazine.
I think so.
Yeah.
But you know what else, too? What else people didn't realize? How he and Jay came about, right? Initially, you know, Puff really wasn't receptive to it. Biggie knew how dope Jay was.
Absolutely.
And he always wanted to lend his hand to anyone else around him that he liked. He'd do anything for
100.
You. So do you know how or why he put my name in Party and Bullshit? Did you ever hear that story?
I didn't know why.
Did you, when you heard it, like, did it bug you out? Like,
yeah, I didn't really make the connection.
Because you didn't introduce me to Biggie.
No.
You ended up being around Biggie.
Right.
We grew up together.
Right.
Puff is in D.C.
Right.
You in D.C. Puff meets me.
Right.
All of these webs,
right.
These tangled webs. Now, so you don't know the story, right?
Not of why he put the lyric in the song, no.
Okay, you don't.
No, I don't.
So this is the first time.
First time.
So in all the years that we've known each other, we've never had this conversation.
Never.
Right? Okay, good. Cameras are rolling. Wonderful. Ready? I was around Puff every day. Puff used to come to Brooklyn all the time. Puff used to bring me to Mount Vernon all the time. He bought his first car, this red burgundy cabriolet. It was a Volkswagen, right? Cool. I'm a street guy in my mind. All of my friends are street cats, but I'm around Puff and we're doing this music thing. So, you know, I'm cabled up. I get into the industry, I get another deal. I didn't sign the Uptown because I wanted some money. Capital had a bag of money, but they didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
So Puff and Andre was like, yo, man, your label mate's going to be Lou Rawls. What's wrong with you? Right. I didn't understand because I'm like, yeah, but you guys are only offering me $150,000.
Right.
That's the budget for the album.
Right.
I'm cool. So I went over there and got that bag.
Right, absolutely.
So now I had a show at the Muse. Remember the Muse on Canal and West Broadway?
Of course.
I got 96 goons with me. All of my, you know them, all right. Jamaican, filthy rich, disgusting, right. Terrible. Nothing to do with music.
Right.
No other recording artist in sight.
Right.
I got to perform. I don't want to perform, but I'm going to perform.
Mm-hmm.
Puff comes in there with this big fat kid with an orange Champion hoodie, sweatshirt on.
Right.
Puff comes on stage. I'm actually on stage getting ready to cue the music.
Mm-hmm.
Puff walks on stage. This is my man. So he's like, yo, I need a favor. I'm like, anything. What's up? He's like, yo, this is my man Biggie Smalls, man. I'm thinking about signing him. Mm-hmm. I want to see how he does in front of a crowd.
Gotcha.
I said, absolutely. Shook his hand.
Mm-hmm.
Good to meet you, man. He said, yo, he's from Brooklyn. I said, what? From Brooklyn? Ah, give me another one.
Even
bow.
Better. Even better.
He got on stage and freestyled to Biz Markie's Doodle Rap instrumental.
Right.
Right after that, his thank you was Party and Bullshit. Can we get along?
Wow.
Higgins ain't chest a little short.
And just hearing that story tells me again and another reminder of who Biggie was. Great guy. Just to show that thanks through, you know, mentioning you in the record. And don't break, I love Party and Bullshit, by the way, but just to hear that lyric is like, oh shit, that's dope.
And it lives forever.
Yeah, it lives forever. It lives forever.
Like, you have to, and that's, right. You have to hear my name associated with my man even after his untimely demise.
Yeah.
Forever. If you're playing any of his catalog, you can't do a tribute party without playing Party and Bullshit.
100%.
Which is why, okay, did you hear the story of me breaking Mr. C's laptop while he was DJing a Biggie tribute party?
About it. Okay. About it.
So you don't know why?
No,
because we never discussed it, right?
No, we never talked about
okay,
it.
Okay, so I'm going to have Mr. C on the show at some time.
Right.
He agreed to do the show.
Okay.
Right? I'm surprised, but he agreed to do the show.
That's right? What's
up. Cool. And I'm going to actually apologize for breaking his laptop.
That's what's up.
Because I shouldn't have did it, right? So with
me
changing my image, right, I'm going to right some wrongs, and I'm going to gift him a laptop on camera.
Good.
Right? Cool.
Good stuff.
So I never went to a Biggie tribute party.
Right.
Too sad. Right? I ended up going to one. Nobody reputable was playing the music.
Right.
Mr. C walks in.
Right.
So I saw him. I spoke. He had just been going through that thing.
Right.
So he had like this thing up, this like chip, you know, he was like on guard.
Right.
That's you. I don't care about that. Right. So I spoke to him. Yo, what up, Mr. C, you good? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, man, it must be what he's going through.
Right.
He gets on the turntables and I'm looking at him and he wouldn't look at me. I'm standing right in front of the DJ booth. He would not make eye contact with me. And he started his Biggie tribute and didn't play Party and Bullshit because it mentioned my name, which told me he had something against me, and I didn't know why.
Right.
So I'm like, why would you play with me on an important night like this,
right,
yearly?
Right.
My man's deaf, you knew him, you don't play no games like that.
Right.
Because
right.
I'm waiting to hear that song so right. I can celebrate this dude in my mind and in my heart.
Right.
I yanked. And I'm talking about this party was as crowded could be.
Right.
So the people that owned the place were so mad at me.
Right.
But I didn't care because I'm thinking big. So
right.
There's footage of of us crying
right.
at the funeral
right.
on YouTube.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I yanked
the plug out and snatched the laptop, broke it over my knee, threw the pieces, got in my karate stance. And I walked out, right?
Right, right.
So that was why. Near and dear. So, you know.
There was bullshit going on in the party.
Yeah. Party of bullshit. So we touched on our relationships with Puffy, Biggie, Mark Pitts, how it all started to thread together.
Right.
And, you know, I came to you early on because everything that you're doing now in business, I saw it on the school bus with baseball cards, right? You were always wheeling and dealing.
Absolutely.
Right? When nothing was going on, this dude was wheeling and dealing.
Trying to figure it out.
But responsible.
Right.
So there was a time that
that came from our parents.
Yeah, we were in the house, right. Me, you, and your brother in the basement. I came over to get him. We were going to a party. You weren't going, and I told you to loan him your car so we could come through in two Lexus coupes.
Right.
And you said hell no, because if he crashes it, he ain't got no money to fix it.
Right. Right.
So I said, well, loan it to me, and I'll let him drive mine. You remember that?
I think so, faintly.
Because, you know, at an early...
I don't know if he was like I think maybe he was just driving at that point.
He was just starting out.
Yeah.
But, you know, at an early age, both of us collectively have always been wheeling and dealing.
Right, absolutely.
So, you know, when you have a vision, it's being able to see the end at the beginning. Right, and having faith to know that whatever you're embarking on will be a successful one.
Absolutely.
So with music, I put it all in because I knew what was coming out.
Right.
So with you, how did you now, because the night that Biggie was killed in L.A., you were there. I was invited, and I said, I'm not going because I can't have my gun on the plane, and you shouldn't go either. This is what I told Big, right? But he had been out there prior to that. But nobody knew he was there until Puff came to town because they started painting the town.
Right.
So now...
Yeah, a record coming out.
Right. So now, many people don't know that you had got hit by a car.
Yeah, so it was the Soul Train. I was actually, I discovered an artist a couple of years back, like 94. I know we skipped to 97, but then I was working with her, Foxy Brown, who became super successful as a female rapper. And I was managing her. So she was also on the Soul Train Awards that same night. That same day. I got into my accident the day of the Soul Train Awards.
And then Biggie was killed the day after. Right.
So what happened was I was going to give her her tickets at what was then the Nico Hotel on La Cienega. And I'm like running, rushing, not paying attention, running across, parked on one side of the street, and then ran across, and I got hit by a car. It was like a freak accident, got hit by a car, went into surgery that night, suffered, a broken leg and a few parts of my leg and some other, cuts and lacerations. But I ended up, the surgery was successful, and what ended up happening was the strangest thing happened when I was in the hospital. So back then, if my hotel phone was only one way. So if I was on a phone, you'd get a busy signal,
mm-hmm.
Right? So for whatever reason, I spoke to my mom, my dad, I spoke to my brother, and I spoke to a few other people, and then everyone else that I spoke to later on said I couldn't get through because your line was always busy. But for whatever reason, Big got through. He was able to call me. He was like, Playboy, what you doing? I remember word for word, like, Playboy, like, what are you doing? We got money to make, like, you laid up, right? He was like, he's like, feel better. He's like, I broke my leg too, right? No, he didn't say I know he broke leg, because I knew he broke his leg. He actually said, I'm recovering the same as you now. Now we both going to be on cane and crutches. That's what he said. Because I believe he was in the car accident maybe a couple months back,
mm-hmm.
in his car, and he was on a cane. So what he said was, yo, get better, man. Take care of yourself. And, I'm going to come check you, is what he said. So that was the night after the Soul Train Awards, and he passed away that same night. They tried to bring him to the hospital that I was in. And then no one wanted me to know that this happened. So they actually disconnected my phone and disconnected my television. And I was like, why is the TV not working? So I was supposed to have TV the next day. But somebody that didn't get the word put my TV back on when I asked. And then I just started throwing stuff in the room, like screaming. I started crying and yelling. And they was like, oh my God, he found out. Because they knew that, I worked with, artists and rappers, and they didn't really know my affiliation to Biggie per se, but someone must have told him that, oh yeah, he rolls with Biggie too, so you might not want to tell him this, because it was the day after, I got out of surgery recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real down moment. And then the next day, like D-Rock, Money L, Little C's, you know, they all came to the hospital because they was already in the hospital, you know, dealing with, you know, everything to, you know, from, you know, taking care of all the arrangements and telling me what happened. And I got to, you know, again, it was just freak accident. I'm laid up in the same hospital that they brought him to when the thing happened. So it was just the craziest, strangest thing. But, you know, I was able to recover. Then, you know, we went to the services. And
we went together.
Yeah, we did. You was pushing me in the wheelchair.
That's right.
I was in a wheelchair for the services. And, you know, it was just a moment in time. Like, it's just, I don't even want to really talk about. But, I mean, it's real. It's life. It happened. And, you know, we kind of wish things turned out differently, but, you know, you can't question God's, you know,
right.
God's plan.
Somebody, that morning, somebody called me, whatever the difference was in time and when they called. It was early, it's probably late LA, early New York. And somebody woke me up, and it was somebody I wasn't talking to at the time. And I thought they were playing a prank. And I answered the phone, and they were like, yo, your man just got killed. And I'm like, what? Who is this? Yo, man, get off my phone. Yeah. Click, I hung up. They called back. Wake up. I'm serious. Yeah. Turn on the TV.
Right.
I hung up again, and I laid there. And I remembered when watching the Soul Train Awards, when Biggie got up to present and the crowd booed, I said to the guy I was watching it with, he better get out of there because they're going to kill him. My exact words. So when I got that phone call and I hung up on the person the second time, I laid in the bed, now I'm up now, thinking, and I thought about him. Because they never actually said who. And I saw it.
So, similar to me, they never said who. When they first turned on the TV in my hospital room, they didn't say who. They said, New York rapper gunned down. Story when they come back. And they went to a commercial, and then they said it. I couldn't believe it. It was like a nightmare. It was like I was in the Twilight Zone. Like,
you know, and not
it's
to...
like, no, that can't be real. What are you talking about?
Ah, you see, and to add to that, you see, what a lot of people don't know is Biggie was who he was, right, in stature. But when he died... An approachable, the last approachable superstar died.
Yeah,
Biggie was so approachable. And I always give the comparison, right? So let me see how you feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Brooklyn, we love our own.
Of course.
Brooklyn respects Jay-Z. They respect what he's done in business. They respect his journey. They respect where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say they don't love him, because we are protective of our own.
Right.
Right? And Brooklyn is different. You can't, like, it's a love that is invisible that you can't even explain.
100%.
Now, when it came to Biggie, Brooklyn actually loved Biggie. To the point where, any given time, you'll see Big on the corner of St. James and Fulton just pulled up, no security, and people surround the car, and he's shaking hands, signing autographs, might buy, send some people to the store, but he's cooling out. He went anywhere he wanted to go.
He can go anywhere.
And that was the difference.
He was Brooklyn's, he was Brooklyn's ambassador, for real. So he repped the borough, not only just with his lyrical talent, but just because of, you know, the way he was.
Separated him.
No, they never separated him. He's one of us. He's one of us. Like even in his lyrics, like he would say, "Black and ugly as ever." However, like he would say, you know, "I'm who I am. I'm from Brooklyn." Yo, he single-handedly made the big guys cool.
Yeah, because if you saw a fat guy back then with a Versace or Coogi sweater on and glasses,
you're trying too hard.
You're trying
now
to be Biggie.
It's like, yeah, right. Now it's like, oh yeah, like
because Rick Ross almost made these guys grow beards.
Right.
He made the beard. He gave that look. Yeah, he gave them a look.
Exactly. So Big did the same thing, but he did it for the whole country, the whole world.
Like, yes.
It was just a moment. Like, it was a movement. It was that thing that just, again, made me happy to be in the music business. Like, I made the right decision. You know, it was sad when the whole thing, you know, happened, but, you know, just being around and just seeing how happy, how much hope it gave everyone that wanted to, you know, aspire to be as great as he was. It made me feel good because it was like, oh man, he's creating. Then he created another business within a business. So what he was able to do for, you know, his friends and his family is create another business underneath a business that another friend of mine was creating. So just to see that happening, mm-hmm. right?
It's like the baby had a baby had a baby.
Exactly, and
Puff, Big, Kim.
Right. They're all creating these, you know, lanes, whether it's, you know, for artistic expression or, you know, someone to get a job that didn't have to, you know, take someone out the street so that they could work and do something. He was building that. Like,
he made Puff cool. He bought Puff more. Puff became a little more in touch with the ground level because he was elevating, right? And levitating everywhere he went. But his connection to Big kept him grounded in the street because
but also for Puff to have the vision to go into out of his zone, which was more like the Harlem uptown kind of, mm-hmm. you know, zone and feel and, you know, move and wear and that whole thing, to go into Brooklyn and say, "You're next. You're the guy. Like, we're gonna take what you have and we're gonna create, you know, the Notorious B.I.G." And for him to have that vision, to see that, when oftentimes, you know, Big probably wanted to be a little more on the rougher edge, but Puff knew how to
dress it.
And yeah, globally, to dress it musically, mm-hmm. and to dress it, you know,
sonically,
sonically
and visibly.
Style and visually, for him to do those two, add those two together, you know, it was creative. Like, it was not like Biggie was something that wasn't duplicated before. You know, even though it's probably going to be duplicated later, it was just so...
It had never happened.
It had never happened. And it was...
It was almost, but never.
It was almost, but never. Yes,
right.
It was almost, but never. And you know, to see, you know, and to hear, like, you know, Craig Mack, who was just so different than Biggie, it really just kind of, like, made Puff explode to a point where now everything else he was doing, he's doing something a little different, all the other, you know, artists that he released. But just to see all of that happen in that moment in time.
The unfolding
of it, and mm-hmm. the maturing and the growth that Biggie did from 93 to 1997 was just
phenomenal.
Man, I wouldn't trade that for the world, man.
Now, and those were great times. Those were great times.
Absolutely.
So it still bugs me out. And every time we would have a conversation, I always wonder, even when I was in jail and I heard you was in the music, I'm like, yo, I could kill this dude. You know what I'm saying? Because that was my brainchild. Right, and now he's an executive at a record company.
Yeah.
That pissed.
Records.
That
the
pissed.
Same, the same label.
Listen,
that
the same label. Right. That which pissed me. That pissed me off so much. B, and I'm sitting in jail, right? And I'm doing this 5 years, and I'm going, yo, you know what? When I get home, I'm going to choke this dude. Because we, do you know how far ahead of the curve we would have been?
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Financially?
Everything.
Everything.
Right.
Right? So, how did you, cousin, how did you go... How did you go from there to Foxy?
So what happened was, being enterprising and always wanting to do business, I opened up a barbershop beauty salon in Brooklyn on Washington Avenue called Moons, right? So what ended up happening was Foxy's brother used to get his hair cut there by a barber named G. So, Anton. So Anton said to G, I know there's this guy, you know, that owns the shop, that's running with Biggie. You know, is there any chance that he could, you know, listen to my sister? Because
I never knew that story.
Yeah, true story.
And I was around.
True story. Yeah, yeah. You. This is 1993. So what?
Because we had the twin Lexus coupes parked in front.
Exactly. The gold and the white. Yeah. So 1993. He introduced me to her. It's exactly 1993. And he said, hey, I want you to meet my sister. She just got dropped from Capitol Records, right? And I said, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know. You know, I'm on the road with Big. I'm working with, you know, Big's team. I'm kind of, you know, getting my feet wet. You know, I got a lot of relationships now. When I was in, you know, school with Puff in D.C. and, you know, Puff's doing big things. That's my guy. You know, maybe I can have some conversation with a few people that I know. And he was like, okay, cool. He was like, I'm going to bring her over to meet you. So he brought her to the barbershop, right? And there was another girl, coincidentally, too, that I was supposed to listen to as well. So one girl, so I was in my truck, I pulled up, I had the Land Cruiser at the time. So I pulled up and she's there with him. She jumps in front, the other girl jumps in the back, right? So the other girl starts rhyming, I'm like, you okay? Then she starts rhyming, I'm like, oh, you're kind of hotter. So I tell the other girl, okay, I'm gonna get back to you. And you know, give me your number, you know, we can talk later.
Do you remember who that was?
Yeah, I remember exactly what. I can't call her name right now. Her real name is Nikki Banks, I think her name is.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember her.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember her. So, she was a little petite girl. Petite girl.
Yes, yes. So what ended up happening was I started me and Inga, we started, you know, conversating. She was like, yeah, I like your vibe, I like your energy. I was like, yeah, let's see where this goes. Nothing happened that day, but let's see where it goes. So she was still in high school. So she would share with me, I didn't know she had all these relationships as well. So she would share with me, like, she's cool with Smooth the Hustler from Brownsville. They had just came out with a record. Somehow she was really cool with AZ. And she had been in the circuit a little bit in Brooklyn, you know, doing talent shows and doing stuff, and actually had a deal. She actually had a deal in Capitol, and it didn't work out only because they changed executives.
Mm-hmm.
So, long story short, we just started picking up from school. We started vibing, and she's like, you know, let's do this. Manage me, and let's see where this goes. So I started working with her. We started going doing demos. We'd go to Clark Kent's house, and again, we used to go to Clark house. I think you would be there sometimes. Jay-Z would be there. Queefin would be there. Like, it was just like a little melting pot of, you know, creative people coming through his house.
Stop right there.
And
stop right there. You don't remember us taking her back to school? She was in high school, but she was doing these classes at Brooklyn College.
Yes. So she was in, that's correct. So
because she was super smart.
Yeah, great. So I forget the name of that school, but it was a high school that was on Brooklyn College's campus or something like that. And she was going to that school. So then we would go to this guy, Dr. Period's house in Brownsville. He had a studio in his house. Then we went to a couple other guys' studios in Brooklyn. We'd just get tracks and do demos, and we'd spit and do records. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, we're in the studio one night. I get a call from Anton, who was really close with Tone from Trackmaster. Mm-hmm. He was like, they want her on this record, I Shot Ya by LL, right? So I'm like, cool. So I tell her, and that was really the big break when she got to feature on that record with LL, Fat Joe, Keith Murray, Prodigy from Mobb Deep, and Foxy had the last verse. So prior to that, I was shopping the demos, and Puff was like, yo, it's cool, it's all right, you know. But, you know, female rappers don't really sell like that, right? He told me. So I'm still a student in the game. So I'm, you know, green under the ears a little bit. He's like, I was like, what do you mean? He was like, you know, Yo-Yo, Light, Latifah, these artists, they're big, they're great, but the actual record sales aren't like a lot of the other, you know, bigger artists. But in between that time, and I don't know if they ever went platinum, but in between that time, the Brat Hat came out and blew up, went
That's
platinum.
That's right, absolutely. Foxy, when Foxy got on that record, right. First of all, she was kind of, I want to say she outshined everybody on that record, and mainly because she was new and no one was expecting it.
Because she had such a low cadence and such a crazy flow that when you heard her, because the record, it was actually the B-side to LL's record, Hey Lover with Boyz II Men. Mm-hmm. So usually B-sides, and this is just how everything ended up working itself together, because usually B-sides don't get a visual back then. It was like, okay, here's the big record, we're going for radio, and here's like the street record to show that, you know, LL can still, you know, get at you, right? So, which was brilliant from the record company side to shoot a video to the B side. It was kind of picking up in the streets.
Well, that was understood from an importance perspective because of the late Chris Lighty.
Right, 1,000%. It was
and he had to translate it to Leo and them, right. Like, and they got it because they trusted him.
100%, and he was in charge of that project. That's how, it's another reason why we even got on that record as well, as the, you know, Tone and Polk and Steve inviting us to even, you know, get on that record with LL, put her on it, and then let LL hear it after. And after LL heard it, he was like, oh, she's dope. Leave it on there. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. No deal, nothing.
No deal.
That was just, you know,
and then the bidding war ensued.
Yeah, then the big bidding war ensued. And people, a lot of people thought she was actually Shaheen, artist that was affiliated with the Wu-Tang.
Because of the tone of voice.
The tone of voice, because she had a, you know, it kind of sounded like, you know, a girl was rapping, but with like a deeper, you know, like the rhyme styles or the tone was similar. So when they heard her and saw her, I mean, when they end up seeing her on the video, you're like, wow, she's incredible. Now everyone wants her. So it was a bidding war, and we ended up going with Def Jam. So there was every label from Interscope to Bad Boy to you name it. Every label wanted it at that point. The record was out. We ended up going with Def Jam, the company who gave us the opportunity to shine in the first place.
So I have a question.
And hence, that was my, you know, my entry.
Intro. That was your entry. That was your entry level.
Entry into.
And what a great way to start.
Yeah.
Right.
I could not have predicted or told you that was going to happen. There's no, the interesting thing about the music game or the music business, there's no particular
like you go to school, you graduate, you get a job, you work. Yeah, I mean, that has happened, but this was just on the job training, on the job learning, like just learning and finding and using some of your own like talent, like to hear something different. Because when she rhymed, I heard something different.
Right.
You know?
So you see, this is that music business has always been an ever changing hand. Yeah. So you could never know all there is to know.
Right.
About anyone or anything, any one thing, because it never stops changing. So I always wanted to know how you made the transition from Foxy Brown to Mary. Because in my mind, I knew Mary first.
Right.
And when I had met her, I was working with Puff and learning the business, and I was eating. And I wanted us to start this record company, and we never did.
Right.
So now fast forward, I'm sitting in prison.
Right.
And I'm replaying my whole life, and I'm kicking myself every step of the way. And then I hear you working with Mary, you working at MCA. I said, I'm gonna kill him, right, you know?
So, how we got there, it was a series of events that actually led there, which is interesting, again, because we start one place and you're doing business with Puffy and Uptown Records and Andre Harrell, and then I end up sitting in some of those seats, like those executive seats. So there was a series of events that actually led to that. What ended up happening is, obviously Foxy blew up. She had great success, and you know, an album came out, did incredible. But leading up to that, we would actually be on the road with Jay-Z and Damon Dash every weekend. Every weekend we went out together. So Foxy and Jay-Z did a record together on Jay-Z's album called Ain't No Nigga. And what ended up happening is that record took off in the street and blew up. And at that particular moment, she was on some other remixes as well. She was on, this is before her album came out, she was on a remix with Little Kim and the Brat for the Total No One Else remix.
Mm-hmm.
She was on Case, Touch Me, Tease Me with Mary.
With Mary.
She was on Toni Braxton's
Making Me High remix.
That Bryce did.
Produced, right? Another connection.
Yep. And then she also had, you know, she did a record with a remix to Horace Brown's single from Motown. And we had all these remixes, and, you know, we were really, it was a really big groundswell. So a lot of people were hearing her on these mixtapes and like, oh my God, what's this girl? She's killing everything she's jumping on, she's killing it, right? So we're getting a lot of calls to do shows. And at the same time, this Ain't No record, it really like took a life of its own and became bigger than all of those records in the street. So all across the country, they were booked every weekend for a year straight. Me, her, our DJ, our road manager, Donald, Gav, and on Jay-Z's side, it would be Jay-Z, Damon, his road manager, Herb Gotti was the DJ, and there was another guy that was with us, and I think we both had security.
DJ Irv.
Yeah, DJ Irv. DJ Irv was on the road. We was grinding every weekend. So we'd leave on Friday, we'd do North Carolina, South Carolina, Friday, Saturday, come back Sunday. Next week, we'll do Atlanta and another part of Georgia. The next, like, we did the whole country weekend by weekend, and just getting all these dates, and then the numbers were going up, the records were getting bigger. She was trying to make an album. So it was like, it really felt like, wow, I got my own artist, and not even knowing how great and big Jay-Z was gonna become. Like, I'm on the road with them for a whole year. We're just going and doing what we gotta do. And they were killing the shows. And then it became, you know, they would do their record together, but they each had their own show towards the end. And then Jay's album came out, blew up, and then he started doing his thing. Then later on that year, Foxy's album came out, blew up. She became successful. They kind of went down separate paths later on. And then maybe around 1998, I get a call saying they're looking for a vice president of A&R, executive vice president of A&R for MCA Records, because they wanted to, you know, have someone that, you know, was having some success and had those relationships in that world to work with the artists that they had and to also sign more artists. So I took the job, and with that came my own label. I know that's the part you're probably in jail, like, oh, now this guy got his own label.
Oh, I was hot. I'm still hot thinking about it now.
So I had an opportunity to get my own label, and I did that. So I had a label deal and a job at the same time, right, which I was able to negotiate. So on the label side, though, I was working with a few artists. I had Killer Priest. They assigned me a few other artists on the label. But they were primarily R&B. Like, they had, you know, the BBDs, they had Patti LaBelle, they had a lot of those, you know, really great R&B acts, which MCA was known for. They had New Edition, Johnny Gill, and all those artists. But MCA was really based in L.A.
L.A. That's where the pouch came from.
Huh?
Remember the pouch?
The pouch, yeah.
You waiting for a check from MCA. Right. You know, you call up maybe Eloise, right? And you'd be like, yo, did my check come? He said, the pouch didn't come in yet. But the pouch, all the money came from L.A.
Right. So the corporate office was in L.A. That's where everyone was based out of. But they had a New York office. So because I was in New York and all my relationships were here, it made more sense that I stay in New York and, you know, build my label and work with some of the artists. So Mary, who was on Uptown prior, ended up going to MCA Direct.
Now, I was one of those Uptown artists. And when Uptown folded, all of the artists went to MCA.
Correct. From Heavy D.
Right. That was 95.
To Mary, to, yeah, all the MCA artists. Even the artists that Heavy D had there also went to MCA. So For Real, all of those artists went there. So what ended up happening is one of the artists that they said that they thought would be a good fit for me to work with was Mary.
Wow.
And I said, oh, I know Mary. We worked together at on the Touch Me, Tease Me record. We shot a video. Record was good. Did, you know, I think they performed together once or twice. And it was on the Nutty Professor soundtrack. So what ended up happening was she was the third artist that, but by far the most important artist probably on the label, because she was the priority of the label. So, but they didn't know that, you know, me and her had a relationship prior until I told them. It was like, okay, great. This should work out then. We ended up working together and doing the No More Drama album together, which has huge success. We ended up doing another album together, which Puffy Executive produced. And then I worked with her for two albums. And then I left MCA maybe 5 years later when I started. And then I always worked with Mary after that from the outside, you know? So we end up getting a relationship from working with Mary, and then obviously that transit. And at that point, I end up, when I left the music business at a point, I decided to go into the restaurant business.
Now wait, stop right there before you get there.
Right.
You see, when Uptown MCA folded, right, all of the artists were shuffled to MCA, the parent company, right? I didn't want to go. And I had just completed the album because I came off of the success of Don Perignon.
Right.
That was 95.
Uptown. With Biggie on it,
yes. Uptown folded. And that was the New York Undercover soundtrack. And again, we shot the video the day after the Source Awards when Suge dissed Puff.
Right.
And if you look at the Don Perignon video, you'll see that all Biggie did was change his pants. He has the same shirt on that he had on the Soul Train Awards. At the Source Awards.
Gotcha.
When he accepted the award.
Right.
And he came straight there and shot the video for me. Right? You know, the album wasn't paid for because Uptown folded.
Right.
The Trackmasters produced the whole album for me, for the most part.
Right.
Steve Stout had access to the album.
Right.
So if the records weren't paid for, they were free records just with my vocals on these tracks. So the remix to Dom Perignon ended up being LL's Who Do You Love?
I remember.
That was the Dom Perignon remix.
I remember that.
Tone from the Trackmasters, being the stand-up guy that he is, when it went down, he called me. And he gave me a heads up. Got nothing but respect for that.
Mm-hmm.
But they said it was Total singing the hook. That was an artist named Billy Lawrence that was on RCA.
Right.
Underneath. And then whoever from Total dropped the vocal on top of it, on right. top of the hook.
Right.
You know? And then there was a song on the album called Rock On.
Uh-huh.
And LL's ad-libs was Rock On.
Right.
So I was a little salty behind that one.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Me and LL got together maybe either later that year. We hung out for a while and was kicking it. We talked about a lot of stuff, including that. Good dude. You know what I'm saying? Good dude.
Great guy.
So, Mary, now, I want to know, because I'm sure that the viewers will be surprised to know that Mary has only had one number one record her whole career.
Yep.
And for her whole incredible catalog, to hear that she's only had one number one record.
Yes.
What record was that, and how did that record come to be?
So, that record. So she's had. She's been. I think. I'm not sure if I'm the one with Method Man. The one that. That one won a Grammy. I think she featured on that one, but it was a feature. That one went number one. But her first solo number one that stood on the charts, I want to say for 13 weeks. I don't have the math correct. Correct me, forgive me if I'm wrong. But that was a record called Family Affair. And that was a record that started out as a record that wasn't too popular when we were creating it, and I don't know if she really liked the beat that much when she first heard it. And then we kind of, you know, got some writers in, put the record together, and then she came back from vacation, jumped on the record, you know, added a lot of her own, you know, her own melodies and lyrics to the record, put the record out. It was actually a beat by Dr. Dre, that's produced by Dr. Dre. And the record, it was just like lightning in a bottle. The record just took off. And it wasn't a traditional, it was like a little bit of a gift to the curse. It wasn't a traditional Mary record.
But you were adamant about her, and she took a chance and trusted you.
She definitely did. She took a chance and trusted me by doing the record, because I was like, this beat's crazy. And then I'm like, I'm gonna get somebody to write to the beat. All right, cool, go ahead, get someone to write to the beat, right? So after putting it together and after doing it, she did trust, you know, that I loved the beat so much that she would do the record. And then it turned out to be lightning in a bottle. The original version and the remix were just like lightning in a bottle. Like, it just like blew up. I think, you know, yeah, she just blew up. And I think she had number ones later on after, but I believe that was her first number one that just like went to the chart, just stuck there.
That's incredible. Mean.
You couldn't move it.
Mean.
Yeah, like it was like.
You know what? Let me tell you this, right? So, Mary, I just, watched your whole transformation.
Right.
And it makes sense when you think about it, because it is all just business, but sprinkled with relationship.
Absolutely.
Because people have to like you, and you have to like people in return. So it's
Absolutely.
Not just...
It has to be a both.
Right. It has to be a fair exchange, of things, right?
Yeah, and it has the chemistry have to work.
So right.
The energy, you know, that we bring around each other every day, as far as business and on, you know, and again, we did such great business together, and then end up turning into a friendship relationship. So
yeah,
so,
and that's the only way that you could successfully work with her, because of her trust issues and so many things that she's going through in her life. Mm-hmm. It has to be some love.
No, absolutely. Definitely love. Love from day one to this day. Nothing's ever changed. She's never changed, and I've never changed. Like, it's just the same. No matter how successful she's become, nothing's ever changed. So that's the great thing about her. And then she's just not only a great student of the game, just a great, her work ethic is unparalleled, like it's unmatched. So we probably share that also when it comes to me wanting to, you know, work and, you know, have things right and, you know, have things, you know, work out not only for us, but everybody around us.
Mm.
I think we share that in common. You know, and I think that's what probably, you know, and it doesn't have to be us working together. You know, she's working to, you know, build her brand. I'm working to build, you know, whatever businesses I'm doing. But the common thread is that, you know, we're getting up every day trying to, you know, just keep reaching and
better
keep
each
climbing
other.
And to better each other, even. Separately, like, you know, whatever I'm doing, and once you find people that have those, you know, similar goals or come from, you know, similar places and just keep wanting to excel and be better at what they do, it becomes easy at that point.
The two angels that have been watching over you.
Absolutely.
Okay, in the physical and now in the essence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We know who we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Right? We leave it there.
Right.
Because I know you know.
Right.
Right? So even on this show, you know, and I'm not a phony person, so when God gives me a word to give somebody, I got to be obedient and say it. Right. But then it's me saying it, right? And you know me very well, right?
Right.
So Absolutely. You know that there's no fluff.
Absolutely.
And I wouldn't lie.
Right?
Right? Cool. When they say your steps are ordered, have you ever heard that?
I heard that.
Cool. He knows.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Right.
Right? But you've been moving on this hoverboard of life, navigating through, and you've been going where life has been taking you.
Right.
And every stop has been great. Every stop
Praise
has been great.
Praise God.
And you've been climbing and climbing and elevating, right? You've been lifted up,
yeah.
Right? So, you know, the pastor in the churches you've been to, all right, cool, great. You ain't gonna get it like I'm gonna give it to you.
Right.
Right, when I give it to you, it ain't gonna be like them giving it to you, because you know where we come from and where we've been and the things we've done.
Absolutely.
So when I come to terms with the word and spirituality, and I'm not, you know, not a Jesus freak, but I get it and I understand why I had to do the things I did to be where I'm at now.
Absolutely.
Right? So even with you, there's nothing but success for you, right? With your family and your businesses and your relationships.
Yeah.
There's nothing but success for you because you're successful.
I think I still have a long way to go. I don't know if people view the things that I've done as successful, but I think I have a longer way to go when it comes to that. I read something the other day that said that 99% of Warren Buffett's wealth
was attained after he was 50 years old. So, and with that, it just seems that there was a lot of knowledge also obtained in order to obtain that wealth. A lot of more relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of information. So I think there's a longer journey still to go, but you know, I'm blessed to have been able to, you know, diversify into other industries and, you know, be successful in a couple of different things in those industries. So that's been a blessing in itself. Probably 2003, I decided to jump into the, you know, food and beverage,
mm-hmm.
Primarily the franchise sector of the food and beverage. So I was able to develop quite a few Papa John's restaurants in the New York City area, in New York City and the Bronx. And then went on to do IHOP with in Brooklyn. We had some success there as well. We did, you know, the first one did like, you know, unbelievably well. We were blessed, able to develop a few more over the course of those years. And now I'm going out and trying to do my own concept, Brooklyn Chop House. We have a restaurant now in Southampton that we just did a pop-up for the summer. It's being very, very well received, and trying to take that energy and bring it back to New York City for our restaurant that we're opening maybe in about a month and a half in Lower Manhattan, and trying to, you know, again, trying something that's not franchise related, because you know, that those concepts, they do have systems in place. They the chances of success are better with franchises. It's a lot riskier, to be honest with you, on the non-franchise side. And it's no secret that, you know, 70% of all restaurants, you know, probably close in the first 2 years. So it's no secret that restaurant is not a risky business, but I have a, you know, a passion for this particular concept that I have. And hopefully we could, you know, build this brand and take it to, you know, a few other markets, you know.
What's the cuisine?
It's actually an Asian steakhouse concept. It's an Asian fusion. It's a steakhouse. We have 50-day dry-aged steaks. We have, you know, combination of, you know, everything is, all our meats are organic, grass-fed, no antibiotics. We're doing something a little different than the norm. It's done before, but we're doing it with a little more of a health-conscious approach to it.
Mm.
And we're using, like, you know, Bell and Evans chicken. For people who know, chicken is the best chicken on the market. It's organic. We're just, I have, you know, a few chefs that have been basically around the block. You know, I'm no chef. You know, I'm the business guy. But, you know, I've, you know, brought in some really good chefs that have done it for the last 20 years in the city. And hopefully, you know, this concept translates to the market that, you know, I'm targeting, and then, you know, everyone supports, you know. It's, you know, for us, it's tough. We just hope everyone comes out, supports. And it's, you know, it's something that, you know, a few people have had success in before. We're just doing our version of it.
So let me ask you this, right? And then we're going to close. But I want to close out on this. My last episode was on prison reform.
Right.
And I'm kind of really heavy into it now. Mentally, and I'm about to be doing some things, right, for like a lot of guys that we know, like, you know, right. Scooters, the Lou Hobbs and mm-hmm. Ken Dews and mm-hmm. all these guys that I have been unfairly sentenced with all this time for nonviolent crimes.
Right.
Not yes. Cool. So coming from where we come from and having, you know, been through the things we've been through, even having some of those relationships that we used to have that, you know, don't really connect to us today because we're not doing the same things.
Right.
But now, as a multiple business owner, mm-hmm. right, how do you now see someone looking for a job? You see yourself in someone that wants to transition and change right. their life. Like, right. what's the hiring process like? And are you, is it solely resume experience, or are you in a position
That is a great question.
You know, are you know I'm getting at?
No, totally. I think I wish that whole system of you did this and you did that means that you can't do this. You know, it's like we got to change the way we hire and give people opportunities, because for me, right, you know, just because I think I've gotten a lot of opportunities because maybe I didn't have that blemish on my record, but even with that blemish on my record, I'm still who I am, and I could still excel and be good with a blemish or a few blemishes on the record. But I think for me, I don't look at the traditional hiring methods. Like, I've taken a lot of people that have had blemishes on their records or a felony or whatever to work for me. There's a couple of people that work for me now that have that. And the reason that I do that is not because necessarily I want to give you a second chance. It's because I look and I do the interview process a little different than how most people do it. I basically look at your skill set, look at your character, and I base my judgment on hiring someone a little different than just being a number or a check in a box. Like, oh, that box is checked. Oh, nah, we can't do that. Like, that doesn't work. Like, because I could have been checked off in a box at one point in life, and I think when you are in that position to own multiple businesses and to give people, you know, opportunity and a job to feed their family and want to do it in an honest manner, it's the same thing as that lady that gave me the opportunity to pack her bags, not knowing whether I had a record or not. She didn't know I had a record. She's just like, oh, pack my bags, go to my house. Like, she just took that same chance on me that I take on people, and 99% of the time, I'm right. This is gonna be that 1% I'm wrong, but so what? Can that 1% make all the other apples bad? No. Like, some people are gonna always be who they are and disguise themselves and fool you in, like, oh yeah, you know, I got over on him. This is who I really am. Yeah, you're gonna have those people, but in all reality, like most people, you know, where we come from, they don't want to deal with, you know, the consequences of doing something wrong or doing something bad. Like, if they could get away with it for a while, it is what it is. But in all reality, they really want an opportunity to succeed and give me the platform or a job or something. Give me a shot. Let me show you what I could do with that shot. Now, once you got that shot, now it's on you to perform. Right, and you take that platform, you grow it, you take your platform, you play with it, you take your platform and you know, fuck it up. You could do many different things with that, but not having a shot at even getting a platform is so, to me, twisted in this society that we live on. And then, you know, not to get into politics, but our leadership even twists that even more so, even spreads that even more wide, so that we can't give people that second chance, that, or the third chance, or even a chance. How about that? Even a chance to get in the game and be in the game like everybody else, to even out the playing field and to do. And I can't solve the world's problem, but if I could take 10 people, and those 10 people now are feeding a family of four each, and then I take another 10 people, and then it becomes now. Slowly but surely, these business owners, like myself, around the country, around the world, now give people an opportunity, you know, and hopefully our business works so that everyone can keep that opportunity, and these people take that opportunity serious,
to help the business, because it's a full circle. You know, you without all of my team, I can't be who I am, right? So I'm trying to build the best team that I can. So back to your question, yes, I think it's almost everyone's obligation to give people a chance. No blemish, blemish. Record, no record. Just qualify them on their, you know, either their training, their skill level, and, you know, their character on what they are able to, you know, if they are able to take the job serious and excel in that position.
Man, I'm so happy that you said that. But I already knew you was going to say that, right? Because I there's no way you couldn't be exactly who you are and sleep good at night. You understand what I'm saying? So it's not that you came out of your circumstances and you're here now and you never look back, turn back, think about, right? You can't. It's impossible. Yeah.
I'm on the stoop.
Come on now.
This is the streets right here.
Hey, man. This has been...
The streets, and this is the smoke behind the street. This is behind the smoke in the street.
This has been Robert Don Poop Cummings.
My man.
Man, it's great interview,
good
man.
Combo.
Not even interview. I can't even call it. I hate saying that, man.
No interview. That was all talk.
Yes, sir.
That's all good talk.
This has been Behind the Smoke.